Good morning. In case anyone doesn't know me, I'm Robin Proud, and I have the honor to be one of the rotating speakers here. And welcome. The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and a welcoming congregation. This means that our invitation is to all, and that all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion. We have a brief words from which are sadly relevant today from Mercy Otis Warren. The rights of individuals ought to be the primary object of all government and cannot be too securely guarded by the most explicit declarations in their favor. I have a couple of short readings from Mercy Otis Warren that are sadly relevant today. It is necessary for every American with becoming energy to endeavor to stop the dissemination of principles evidently destructive of the cause for which they have bled. It must be the combined virtue of the rulers and of the people to do this and to rescue and save their civil and religious rights from the outstretched arm of tyranny, which may appear under any mode or form of government. And at the very end of her original manuscript on the American Revolution, she concludes with this: "It is an unpleasing part of history when corruption begins to prevail, when degeneracy marks the manners of the people and weakens the sinews of the state. If this should ever become the deplorable situation of the United States, let some unborn historian in a far distant day detail the lapse and hold up the contrast between a simple, virtuous, and free people and a degenerate, servile race of beings corrupted by wealth, effeminate by luxury, impoverished by licentiousness, and become the automatons of intoxicated ambition." I think it might be amusing to put a meme out with these words about the servile race of beings corrupted by wealth and the automatons of intoxicated ambition. And we could think of a few people whose pictures could be placed with that. John Adams called her the most accomplished woman in America. During the Revolution, she was the Stephen Colbert of her time, writing satirical plays, skewering the British and the Loyalists. And after the war, she was one of the first to write a complete history of the American Revolution. In the recent Ken Burns documentary, she was voiced by Meryl Streep, only fitting for this outstanding woman, Mercy Otis Warren. She was born near Cape Cod in 1728, the third child and first daughter of James Otis Sr., a merchant, attorney, and judge, and his wife, Mary Ellen, who was also from a well-connected family and a Mayflower descendant. They had 13 children, seven of whom survived, which was not unusual for the time. The family farm workers included indentured servants, American Indians, and at least one African-American slave. They lived in a mansion graced by silver, mahogany, rum, and wine. The first son, James Jr., loved studying, and their father encouraged Mercy to share the family tutor. Later, when James Jr. went to Harvard, he shared his books and learning with his sister. Mercy was 26 when she married James Warren. As with John and Abigail Adams, it seems to have been a love match. James was also from a prominent family, and he approved of Mercy's education and interests. They eventually had four sons. In contrast with the usual strict approach to child rearing, Mercy believed parents should raise children with kindness and patience. Mercy corresponded regularly with her brother, whom she called Jemmy. So her husband was James, her brother was Jemmy. And both of them were very active in early opposition to British rule. Leading patriots met in Mercy's living room, where she took part in political and strategic discussions. And it was during this time that Jemmy was the first to proclaim, "Taxation without representation is tyranny." John Adams, describing this meeting, said, "Otis was a flame of fire." But this outspokenness had consequences. In 1760, so this is well before the Revolution, Jemmy argued with a customs agent in a Boston coffee house. The agent's friends assaulted Jemmy with canes, and he was so badly beaten that he suffered brain damage. He was never the same again, sometimes flying into unpredictable rages, sometimes speaking in a rambling manner for hours, or sometimes withdrawing totally, sometimes needing to be hauled away in a straitjacket, which I had no idea those existed back then. Mercy had always looked up to her adored brother. Her great sorrow spurred her into using her own pen to continue Jemmy's work. Some of Mercy's earliest writings were in support of boycotting British goods. And around this time, she had her first satirical play published called The Adulator. It was under a pseudonym, but her friends and family knew and were proud of her. It became so well known that people began to refer to the hated Governor Hutchinson by the name Mercy had used, Rapatio. So a bit like memes today, right? That there is something that takes off as a saying or a name for a particular character. People begin to use that. Right after the Boston Tea Party, John Adams, who was a friend, asked Mercy to write a satirical poem commemorating the event. She wrote in the mock epic style known by readers of Alexander Pope, The Squabble of the Sea Nymphs, about a quarrel among gods and goddesses arising from a scarcity of nectar and ambrosia to represent the tea. Mercy was unsure of the merit of this lightweight endeavor, so she sent it to John Adams, saying that if he didn't approve, she would, quote, lay aside the pen of the poet. But he dubbed it an incontestable evidence of real genius and arranged for it to be published in the Boston Gazette. The divisive tone of this era is all too familiar to us today. Neighbors and family members who had lived with each other for decades divided over their views on loyalty to the English king and the rights of the colonists. Jemmy's was far from the only beating. Again, if you watch the Ken Burns documentary, there were attacks on both sides, houses looted and burned, families leaving town overnight, sometimes just leaving the cities for the countryside, sometimes going to Canada. Meanwhile, while Mercy was conducting a literary campaign, her husband James was directly involved in politics. He was a member of the Massachusetts Provincial Congress, but the British government kept imposing their own members on these councils. In 1774, Mercy wrote her next play, The Group, and it showed these British councillors as selfish hypocrites and especially condemned their attitudes toward women. Mercy was never as outspoken about women's rights as Abigail Adams, but she did make the comparison between the subservient status of colonists in the world and women in the home. In January 1775, new regiments of British soldiers arrived in Boston, and maybe right now we can especially appreciate occupation by enforcers was unwelcome, to say the least. Mercy's husband, James, told her to prepare trunks in case they had to leave on short notice. And in April, Mercy reported an eyewitness account of the pitiful retreat of British soldiers after the battles of Lexington and Concord. Although Mercy didn't personally witness the Battle of Bunker Hill, she did tour the site not long afterwards, and she saw how an entire neighborhood had been destroyed, including a number of her friends' homes. During this difficult time, Mercy and Abigail Adams supported each other while their husbands were away. John Adams requested that Mercy send him reports of the on-the-ground action in Boston. James was now the paymaster general of the Continental Army, and Mercy was dealing with an 18th century sandwich generation, supervising her young adult sons and caring for her ailing father. Now, at this time, John Adams, who famously laughed at his wife's suggestion to consider the ladies, wrote to James Warren about the qualities of their wives. He had given them Latin names, Portia for Abigail and Marcia for Mercy. Adams wrote that although in general, women should be spared, quote, the arduous cares of war and state, he also wrote, I certainly think that Marcia and Portia ought to be exceptions, because I have ever ascribed to those ladies a share, and no small one either, in the conduct of our American affairs. Throughout the Revolution and the early Republic, Abigail and Mercy were both torn. They wanted their husbands to be pillars of this new construction, but they missed them at home. George Washington asked James to continue as paymaster on the Army's march to New York, but James had just recovered from a serious illness, so he declined. And around this time, the couple's eldest son, James Jr., was sent home from Harvard after a breakdown, which may have been psychological and may have been the effect of heavy drinking, gambling, and wenching. A new fear arrived in 1776 with a smallpox epidemic. The Adamses and the Otises took advantage of so-called hospitals where patients were inoculated with small amounts of the disease. And again, you might remember that Washington chose to have his soldiers inoculated. Now, this often made them ill for as long as 3 or 4 weeks, but it also made them immune, and it tended to not be anywhere near as serious as the actual disease. While the Adamses brought their children along, Mercy decided she should go first so that she could nurse her children later if needed. This happened in mid-July, so it was there that these families learned of the brand new Declaration of Independence. Inspired to serve the new nation, James became a member of the Continental Navy Board while also serving in the militia with the title of Major General. By 1779, James was a member of the Massachusetts House of Representatives and was asked to attend the Continental Congress, but in this case, he declined because of Mercy's physical and emotional health. She had suffered from eye problems and headaches and was dealing with grief after losing her father and a close friend. There were constant worries about their second son, Winslow, who was living the high life, drinking, gambling, and refusing to settle on a profession. Finally, when Great Britain signed the Proclamation of Peace, the resultant celebrations brought the return of Mercy's brother, Jemmy, who had mostly been isolated since his injuries. Visitors flocked to see the famous rebel, but after a few days, the crowds were overwhelming and caused him to return to his state of alternate raving and silence. He went back home, and a few months later, he was standing in a doorway observing a thunderstorm when he was suddenly struck by lightning and died instantly. John Adams wrote about him from France. He was as extraordinary in death as in life. Mercy's son Winslow encouraged her to write a play about the quest for liberty based on an example from foreign history. She chose a story from Spain for her play, which she titled The Ladies of Castile. It centered on women's contributions and sacrifices during a time of patriotism. She also wrote one called The Sack of Rome, which again featured patriot virtues and the experiences of women. Mercy and James Warren disagreed with John Adams over the new Constitution, feeling it gave too many powers to the executive and judicial branches. And at that time, it lacked the amendments that would guarantee freedoms from the type of mistreatment the British had inflicted on the colonies. And Mercy objected to the idea that Congress could set its own salaries. She published several articles and pamphlets opposing the Constitution in its current form. And James decided it was time to return to the Massachusetts House, where he was elected Speaker. So this disagreement with the Adamses, compounded by some others and personal conflicts, led to a break in the friendship between the Otises and the Adamses. Mercy continued to write. She published a group of poems in 1790 dedicated to George Washington. This break between friends intensified when Adams passed the Alien and Sedition Acts in 1798. Now, these have been in the news recently, too. They made it harder to establish residency. They made it easier to deport anyone considered a threat to the state. And they allowed punishing anyone who performed the treasonous act of, quote, writing against the government of the United States. Mercy dubbed this despotism. One of Thomas Jefferson's first deeds as a president was to cancel those acts. In 1791, Washington raised an army to deal with Indian conflicts in the West. Winslow, their scapegrace son, to escape debts and scandals, enlisted and within 6 months was killed in an unexpected Indian attack on his fort. Mercy turned her attention to some of her grandchildren and carried out her belief that girls should have the same learning as boys, and she devoted herself to finishing her history of the Revolution. She consulted with a friend, the Unitarian minister James Freeman of Boston. I wasn't able to find specific information on Mercy's religious beliefs. Her family had Puritan and Calvinist roots, but her intimacy with Freeman, who was a Unitarian minister, and the Adamses shows she was of like mind with contemporary Unitarians. It seems to me that what she took from her religion of birth was the code of morality that individuals and societies should use as a guide, rather than in condemnation of sinners or unbelievers. Mercy completed her history in 1804 at the age of 76. The publisher, concerned that the author was a woman, offered to print only 1,000 copies. Mercy objected and created a list of subscribers, including Thomas Jefferson, that is, people who were promising to buy the book. Some of her friends were concerned that earlier male authors had covered the same ground, but 1,500 were finally printed, and views were mixed. John Adams was not happy about some of her statements. She said his passion and prejudices were sometimes too strong for his sagacity and judgment, and he insisted everything he had done had been for the public good. And she did point out some of the times when he seemed to approve of certain features of monarchy. He wrote some very nasty letters, and Mercy took offense in her turn, insisting her book was impartial. Eventually, Adams's claims became more and more exaggerated, saying her party was responsible for an inundation of atheism, deism, annihilation, gambling, contempt of marriage, and the Sabbath. Mercy refused to rewrite her book, of course. It wasn't until 8 years later that, partly through the intercession of family members, she reestablished a friendship with Abigail Adams and finally with John as they were all getting older. Mercy Otis Warren died in 1814 at the age of 86. But thanks to her writings, we still have access to her sense of humor, her sharp mind, and her eyewitness accounts of much of the Revolutionary War period. And a couple of books I used, this one I got from the library, The Muse of the Revolution, The Secret Pen of Mercy Otis Warren and the Founding of a Nation. It is only about 260 pages with not counting the notes. But another one that's even more accessible, this might be written for high school students, but it has all the main information. It has a lot of visuals in it. Mercy Otis Warren, author and historian. Any questions or comments? If you are familiar with the show Hamilton, it's not totally historically correct, but it does show something about the formation of political parties. Washington and some of the early founding fathers thought that political parties were a terrible idea. And they also thought you shouldn't blatantly run for office. You're supposed to reluctantly agree as a service. As we saw when it got to the time of Jefferson versus Adams, parties began to spring up and campaigning became a bigger thing and vilifying your opponent. So Washington was unusual in being above the fray and not necessarily wanting to be president, right? My understanding is he had retired once from the military. Adams was definitely ambitious. Unfortunately, the faction started very early on and maybe took over from the whole Tories versus Patriots. And some people were never forgiven. I was aware of her. I did a talk a long time ago, Founding Mothers, where Mercy Otis Warren was briefly one that was mentioned. And early on in the colonial times and early revolution, in some places there were more men, so the women had more power, were able to choose who they could marry sometimes. And because there weren't a lot of people, if the men were away fighting or hunting or at constitutional conventions, the women, like Abigail Adams, were running their farms and businesses. Benjamin Franklin's sister ran the post office for him, that sort of thing. And later, as it got more into the Victorian era, there was more this idea, women should only be in the home. So there was a certain freedom. So I was inspired by that series and the idea that the official 250th anniversary celebrations we see, I imagine, are going to be very much like what we learned about in 1950s. Some people ask that, like, well, what would happen if these people start changing all our textbooks and schools? Like, well, we know we were there in the 1950s and 60s. It was very rah-rah. Expansion to the West was great and all this empty land and, you know, slavery wasn't so bad. And yeah. Adams accused her of being an atheist, but I think she was conventional. But that's what I was trying to find out. She was from this Puritan Calvinist background, but the fact that she consorted with the Unitarians, and she did not seem to write a lot about, she did not write a lot about religion or God being on their side and so on, which, you know, for some people that was really, really a huge part of their daily life. So she seemed to really believe in the virtues of democracy. I may be making that up because we just don't have much information. And the licentiousness goes back to what Wood was referring to. I think that we seem to have all these things corrupted by wealth, power, and licentiousness. The only one I thought was a little interesting, effeminate by luxury. I'm not sure I agree with effeminate as the word there, but the idea is weakened. People are those people with the money are used to having everything, which that does occur today. We don't always use the word faith here a lot, but we have faith in things like democracy that we believe strongly in and want to uphold. And our closing words are just this one sentence from Mercy Otis Warren: democratic principles are the result of equality of condition.